Are they nice? They're called Third Time Out. How Great Thou Art. A little Southern Gospel harmony for you. Nice stuff. 9 minutes after the hour on a Broken Road Radio Monday. Dr. Don joins us. Don Clark, a biochemist and member of the board of Creation Moments. He's in Garden Valley, Texas, growing grapes, even in the winter. What do you have to do with your grapes in the winter, Don? Do you have to do this work to do?
Yeah, there's work to do. Repair trellises. Tighten the trellis. Prune.
But even in Texas, the grapes are dormant now, aren't they? The vines.
Oh, yeah. Okay. They've been dormant for a month or so.
Okay. So. And early spring comes to Texas. Maybe March? You see it warm up and.
We'll begin to see some warmer weather in March, maybe end of February, but looks like this year it's going to be March.
Okay.
And by April, we're well into spring, and the vines will have budded, and we're off and running.
Okay. Well, that's when the work really begins, I guess. There was a debate last week. And it was Ken Ham at Answers in Genesis, and it was Bill Nye, the science guy, together in Kentucky at the Answers in Genesis facility there, which I guess is just across the river from Cincinnati, right? It's in Kentucky.
It is. Yes, and it is. It's right. It's actually very near the airport.
Okay.
It's on the same road that
like Covington, maybe? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you would take to go to the airport.
Yeah.
And it's like right across the road there.
Now, have you been there? Have you seen the facility?
I have. It's been a number of years ago. They keep adding. And right now they've got a fundraising going on to build a full size ark on their property.
Okay, and hence the debate. That's part of the fundraising effort, I believe, wasn't it?
I'm not sure. I really don't know how the debate came about. I mean, we know.
Well, I suspect it was because they filled the auditorium and they're selling DVDs and things. So I'm sure it's at least a part of the motivation for that. But it's an age old debate that goes on and on and on. I'm not sure that we ever resolve it by debating. In fact, I question that approach to it. To me, that seems a little flashy. I mean, to make it sport is one thing. But I'd almost rather see them each just write a paper on it and then put it out there for dissemination and debate and dissection by the scientific community and the religious community. What did you think of the debate? Did you get a chance to see it?
I did. We were off at the time the debate was going on. We were actually down in Tyler listening to Charles Krauthammer,
one of my heroes,
was giving a speech, nothing to do with the debate, but as you know, he's a political commentary. Mm-hmm. And
I've got his book. I got it for Christmas.
He mentioned it several times.
I'll bet he did.
People would ask him questions, and he said, "Well, that's in chapter so and so of my book, or that's in the introduction to my book." It became a joke after a while. But no, he was very good. And then after we got home, I looked online and started watching the debate online. It was well over 2.5 hours long, and that included the question and answer period. Overall, I would say, sometimes when you watch folks debate, it's more of a mannerism than it is of content. And from the point of view of personality, Bill Nye had it all over Ken Ham.
Well, Ken Ham is not the most congenial sort. Although I guess they were both civil. I mean, it was a civil debate.
Oh, it was a civil debate, yes. But Ken does not present himself as a very friendly guy, and it's just his personality. Mm-hmm. Whereas Bill, of course, he's got his television show, so he's quite personable, and he expressed several times his excitement over science. Now, had I been debating, I would have expressed my excitement over science and, the wonder of creation and how the more we explore, the more we don't know, how exciting that is that we will never have an end to this process. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't how, unfortunately, Ken Ham, came over. So, from a personality point of view, I think Bill kind of, won the debate. But from content, They neither did a very good job. Bill Nye brought up some ridiculous. He continues to make these ridiculous comments. One of them was that he kept referring to, Ken's creation as opposed to God's creation, and he kept referring to the American English translation of the Bible. Ken was quoting scripture from the King James, which is not an American translation. Yes, it's an English translation, but it's a very good, almost literal translation of the Hebrew.
Now I have to ask: is Bill Nye simply a an evolutionist, or is he also an atheist?
Oh, he's an atheist.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, he's an evolutionist, atheist. Mm-hmm. So at least he's consistent from that point of view. So he was, in essence, one of his comments was like, well, you know, you tell a story enough times through people. We all know the game that you play, that if you, you know, translate the Bible enough times, it was the inference, then it's not going to be very accurate at all, which is totally ludicrous, of course. If he had done any study at all on scripture, he would have known that the authenticity of of the Bible and its accuracy is one of the most important.
Well, confirm this for me. Don't most scholars, both Christian and non, agree that what we have in the Bible, in Scripture these days, is an accurate representation of the Greek and the ancient Hebrew? Now, that's not to say 100%. There are certain words that are up for debate. There are certain words that were maybe misinterpreted. There are some scribal emendations to it, like the ending of Mark. I mean, some Bibles it's there, and some Bibles it's not. But basically, what we have to read is accurate. Don't scholars pretty well agree on that?
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so.
Now, you got your
message, the message translation, which is a, you know, transliteration as opposed to, you know, here's what we think it means in a more colloquial type of language.
Paraphrases are better,
As opposed to the King James, which is much, much closer to the Greek, for example, the Pentateuch in this case, than like the Message.
Mm-hmm.
But so that was one comment that Bill kept making over and over again, and then it just was, obviously it didn't hold much water. Another thing that he hammered Ken Ham on was, it's only been 4,000 years. It's only been 4,000 years, since the flood. Or since creation, well, it's been longer than 4,000 years. It's been about 4,400 years since the flood. But the point was, how could you have this much change in such a short period of time? Ken made some comments back along those lines. One of which was a scriptural content. Which, in a setting like this, Scripture's not going to win your other, the arguments for you in a debate setting like this.
Mm-hmm.
Ken did a very good job of presenting the gospel multiple times, and he did a good job of explaining his point of view. But I think there were a lot of missed opportunities where, from a scientific point of view, you could have come back to some of the arguments that Bill Nye was making, truly debated them and say, hey, look, studies have been done on the structural integrity, for example, of the ark, and it was the size and shape of the ark would have made it very, very structurally sound. Not only that, the harmonics that get built into a vessel that size was such to minimize or eliminate the human harmonics, which would have made everybody throw up had it not been built correctly. So that type of information needed to be brought out strongly. And unfortunately, Ken was not a strong enough scientist or didn't have those that data at the tip of his fingers to be able to regurgitate it, if you will, in a setting like that.
Yeah, my take on Ken Ham is that he's probably not the strongest spokesman to be out there arguing the young Earth and creationist position. I know he's got a radio show. I've heard it. He tends to lambast his opposition. You know, I much prefer what Creation Moments does. I guess that, well, this is another challenge I'd love to talk to you about. But how do we get the Creation Moments kind of a calm, rational, reasonable approach to this subject out in front of people to get more attention to the content again and not the style?
Well, yeah, these type of debates are few and far between these days, because most evolutionists have been trained that evolution is fact, and so therefore we don't have to debate it. And oh, by the way, you better not debate somebody who's really good in creation science, because you will lose. And that was indeed the case years ago when Dwayne Gish and Henry Morris and Kent Hovind, for example, were out debating people. They would always win their argument because they had the science behind them and presented it in such a way in a, that you know, it was irrefutable, at least in a verbal format.
Well, there is valid science that verifies the young Earth position, or at least supports it, and supports it strongly. And I'd love for that to be heard in more venues and in more ways. And I just, and again, I just don't think a highly publicized debate, you know, highly charged as it was, is the best way to get that information across. Biologos, go ahead,
Don. I've got a Fox News story that from the 5th of November, and it says down at the bottom that the debate began after Nye was did an online video in 2012 urging parents not to pass their religious-based doubts about evolution onto their kids. And then Ham did his own video rebutting Nye's statements, and then the two later on said, well, let's do this.
And that's how it came to be then, yeah.
Why do you think this particular debate has gotten so much attention? Now, that's a Fox News story. You know, I've seen, you know, a lot of other references to it on a number of other traditional mainline media story websites and news outlets. You know, Time Magazine has got a story about it. And the Bill Nye Ken Ham debate was a nightmare for science. It's on a website called The Daily Beast, and NPR has done a story. Why this debate getting so much attention?
Well, I think because Bill Nye's video got so much attention. It had so many hits because well, the Christians were watching it because they were angry over his comments. It's a ridiculous comment to say that you can't do good science if you believe in creation, which he mentioned during the debate. It's a fallacious argument. I mean, it's like you turn your mind off because you have a different point of view than some other people. Of course you don't do that, and of course you can learn and be creative, and I would argue you're even more creative if you're following the truth as opposed to not following the truth. So it was that video that really started the rage, and so this was a continuation of the I think of the wave that that caused. And so it was a big opportunity to, have a lot of folks, watching the debate, and therefore subsequently a lot of folks commenting on it.
I've mentioned this a couple of times that at one of the time when I was back in my undergraduate days or graduate days, I don't remember which, but I took a course on called The History of Science, and it outlaid the process or the steps that a civilization will take when it finally comes to terms about a scientific proposition that doesn't make sense anymore. But slowly but slowly you pick away at the edges and you realize, this thing doesn't really hold water. And the story of Copernicus and the story of Galileo and the story of, you know, of a number of other scientific discoveries. And, you know, these things don't necessarily take a week and a half. Sometimes they take hundreds of years. And evolution seems like it's fraying at the edges.
Oh, yeah, it's been fraying at the edges. It's been shooting at the foundations, I would say, really, of foundations of Christianity. There are, of course, a lot of people that would disagree with me on that particular issue, but there is good reason why, you know, people would want to believe that all this came about naturally, and that there wasn't a creator God, you know, involved in the process. And that really is at the heart of the issue. It's not really, you know, good science versus bad science. It's at the heart of man. Now, I will give Ken Ham, you know, credit in that he mentioned that during the debate. Now, most people just probably it didn't affect them one bit. But you know, from I think from a preaching point of view, Ken did an excellent job. But from a scientific point of view, well, okay, it was a little weak.
Well, now there's another position, and that's the position presented by BioLogos, which is a website put together for old Earth creationists, or at least those are the folks that furnish the information. They have people on there from the realm of science and Old Testament scholar John Walton comments, and their article on the debate is called Ham on Nye, which is kind of cute. I like that take. They profess creationism, but an old Earth that took billions of years to develop. And it's a calm and rational approach. I like the tone of their writings. I don't agree with everything they say. As this podcast is put up on our website later today, there will be a link to that article. But if you care to search, it's just biologos.org. You could search for Ham on Nye, our take. And there's also a link from the Internet Monk site on that. But there's an article in there by a fellow in biology. His name is Dennis Venema. And he's talking about a bacteria, and some of the things he's touting is proof of evolution. Now, he holds a Christian perspective on creationism, but he said, you know, it would be old Earth. It took billions of years, and this particular effect shows that evolution is the means by which God used to bring us to the current state. You have some comments on that experiment with bacteria. What is that all about? Because it's an old one, I guess. It's been around for a while.
Around for a while. A researcher by the name of Richard Linsky said, well, I'm going to just take some E. coli and I'm just going to grow them up and keep growing them from generation to generation to generation, and then we're going to watch for some changes. Well, that's what they did. And after billions of bacteria, they finally got a culture that had some change. Now, let's talk about the change that was observed. They found that ordinarily under oxygen conditions or aerobic conditions, the bacteria will use glucose as its food source or as its carbon source. They found a group of bacteria that started to use citrate as its carbon source. Now, there's not enough information here to know, is it the only food source, or are they still using glucose as well, and then also are using citrate? The evolutionists say, wow, you see, there's new information being generated, and you know,
well, the way they describe it is the bacteria developed a new function all by itself.
Right. And that's hogwash, because it didn't. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you why.
Please do.
Because E. coli naturally has the ability to use citrate in an anaerobic situation, that is, without oxygen. So what we have here is bacteria, they didn't gain any information. They probably lost information in the control mechanisms in their genes. So no new genes were made. And like I said, more than likely there was a mutation, and all of the evidence about mutations, which is another, you know, subject, is, you know, that mutations do not benefit an organism, but only create, you know, negative effects, neutral at best. And here's one that one would say, oh, well, this is a beneficial mutation. And I would argue it's, you know, first, no new information is being generated, and indeed, information is being lost, whether it's in the control of that particular gene during, you know, aerobic conditions. We've got all kinds of control mechanisms. I mean, not only do we have the genes which code for the proteins involved, but there's, as we have talked about on this program, there's all kinds of control mechanisms which we don't even understand yet. If you have caused a malfunction in the control mechanism that turns the citrate genes, and there's probably many of them, on or off, in this case, it turns them on when they should be turned off, then that's a loss of information and not a gain of information.
So you're saying the gene to do this was there all along. It was there from the beginning. Oh,
absolutely, and they admit it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
admit that the gene was there. So,
well, you know, anytime you read an opinion from somebody who was a fellow of biology, I don't really know what that means, but when he makes a biological statement and says this is the way it is, science has proven this, as a layperson, you tend to say, well, okay, I'll accept that. But what you need to think about is that science is a process where there are multiple observations of a phenomenon and a lot of gaps in between. And so you apply logic to that. You try to make an explanation. It evolves into a theory. But sometimes the basic assumptions are just plain wrong. And there's a lot of educated guesswork in there, isn't there?
There certainly is, and it depends on your worldview. If your worldview is that we evolved, then you would take this information and say, you see, new information has been created. Mm-hmm. There's a new trait there, which implies, they say new trait, which, you know, implies new information. But in fact, if you take a creation point of view, where no new information is being generated, and we are actually under devolution instead of evolution, then no new information is being generated, but information is being lost. And you can get the same result taking it, you know, looking at it from two different points of view, depending on your worldview.
Are we capable as human beings of doing purely objective science, or is there always bias?
You would hope that you could be as objective as possible. Mm-hmm. But when you're dealing with populations, as in this case, of billions and billions of bacteria, you can't just look at one bacteria and say, well, we have completely sequenced the genome in this bacteria, and it is different from this other bacteria. Mm-hmm. You have to look at a population of bacteria in order to be able to do that, to get enough stuff, the DNA in this case, to do the experiment. But there are safeguards that you could put in, for example. You could just start looking at the very details of the whole genome. Now, you know, this presupposes that you know what the whole genome of E. coli would do and what its function is, and we don't even know that. So it just takes to sort these things out.
Here's another perspective I want you to comment on, and this is another comment in the Ham on Nye article. And this comes from Ted Davis, who is a fellow for the history of science. And that seems to be a study I'd like to delve into here. But this is an interesting statement to me. A central point of the debate was whether the historical sciences, I guess that means archaeology, paleontology, that sort of thing, whether the historical sciences are actually sciences, in quote marks, sciences in the legitimate sense or somehow distinct from observational and experimental sciences. And we tend to say science like there's a monolith there. There's science, and it means truth. But in fact, is there a distinction between historical sciences and experimental observational science?
Well, this was the point that Ken Ham was making in one of his major points when he talks. He will always talk about, excuse me, observational science versus historical science. Now, when you're talking about the origins, you are talking about history because, what do we know? We know that we're here, and at some point we weren't here. So you can't go back and repeat the experiment. I mean, you can't go back and create a primordial soup, for example, and go from molecules to man because it wouldn't happen. But, the evolutionists would say, well, there's just not enough time for that to happen. So we can't look at that. And so that's what is meant by, kind of historical science. Mm-hmm. And you can do science on, things that you see. For example, the fossils. I mean, we do, radioisotope dating. And you can look at layers in the Earth and do radioisotope dating. Now, whether that means anything is, we can talk about that. But you can do scientific studies to, try to build up your hypothesis. But to, say 100%, yes, this is absolutely fact, I think with something like a historical science that you can't repeat, mm-hmm. Which is the main premise behind the scientific method, there is, it's not as strong, let's put it this way, as a observable something you can observe and then do an experiment, having a hypothesis, do an experiment, and then observe again to see if you get the same results. That's a much stronger form of science than doing something after the fact and trying to explain it away through doing simple simpler tests. That, like I said, like the age of the Earth, to try to get its age by mm-hmm. doing radioisotope dating.
Well, then I'm tempted to say that just because a discipline ends in OLOGY, archaeology, biology, physiology, paleontology, doesn't necessarily mean science. Science might be only one of the tools used in the discipline, and there's a whole lot of detective work, a whole lot of educated guesswork. And some assumptions. And we've learned, we talk with John Delancey frequently up until recent months. He's an archaeologist, and his point was there's so much art involved in archaeology that science almost gets second billing. There's so much interpretation, and again, a personal bias creeps in as to how archaeological relics and artifacts are interpreted and dated. So it's maybe much less science and much more art in a lot of ways than something else we think of as science, like maybe biology. So just the OLOGY ending maybe doesn't mean science and doesn't mean fact and doesn't necessarily mean truth.
Well, no, and all it means is knowledge, the mm-hmm. acquisition of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're interpreting the knowledge correctly. Mm-hmm. It just means that you're studying it, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's good to, it's good to study these things. It's good to look at bones and try to figure out where they came from or who they belong to or, civilizations and say, well, it looks like there was a large civilization here. Why did they die off? Those questions I think are important. But to state that you absolutely, positively know exactly what happened in, those situations, I think is stretching it far beyond what the tools we have today, mm-hmm. would tell us about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it pays to remain a skeptic, I think, and be open. And Don, I'm just as pleased as always that we have you to talk in a sensible and calm and collected way about the young Earth position. Because, again, I personally believe there's some very convincing science on that side of the argument, but it doesn't get heard enough, and that's kind of why we talk to you everywhere.
Go ahead, David.
Go ahead and respond to what Jim said, and I've got another thought.
Well, yeah, just I mean, for example, just talking about the end quote young Earth, one aspect of a young Earth is that, gee, there's not enough salt in the ocean for the Earth to have been, millions of years old. But that, you never hear that. You're not going to find that in a geology book. Why don't you find that in a geology book? You know, that there is not enough salt, to state that, hey, this is only thousands of years old as opposed to billions. Well, I mean, millions. And that's the reason why you don't see it. So information is being purposefully kept out, not because it's not good science. It's because it goes against the philosophy. Mm-hmm. It goes against the worldview, and that's the saddest thing of all. Because unless we are teaching our children ourselves, or going to sites like Answers in Genesis or Creation Moments or Institute of Creation Research, and pulling up the materials that are there and teaching our children those type of things, they don't get it in the schools.
I wonder and that's not my question I was thinking about, but this is a different question you just brought up. I wonder when this intention to indoctrinate began, and particularly in this country, the decision that we want to make sure that the kiddies get it the way that we want them to understand life, and we want to make sure that we stuff their heads full of this kind of information, and not encourage them to look out beyond these boundaries. I wonder when that started.
Well, there was a debate years and years ago, as you may, the Scopes trial, for example, which was a form of legal debate. Does a biology, science teacher have the right to teach evolution? And not teach creation. It was on the other side. Now, the Christian attorney actually won his case.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But there is also, a movie about the Scopes trials that he loses his case. And a matter of fact, the Christian attorney is made to look like an imbecile.
William Jennings Bryan, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Clarence Darrow on the other side, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure you remember the movie. Mm-hmm. And that began to color people's opinion. It wasn't the facts. It was a made-up story to push an agenda. And from that time, this is the power of movies. You can flavor the population, just by presenting your case in twisting the facts, in this case, turning them upside down, so that you can push your point of view. And I think this has been going on, this is a battle. I mean, this is obviously, it's a spiritual battle. But it's a battle it has been a battle in this country, because if you believe that there is a loving God and he created us, and he created us in a certain number of days, in this case six, and that you can rely on the Bible and it is accurate, then you might have some moral principles that you might need to live by. But if we can push the agenda of evolution in long periods of time, and we just evolved from apes or chimpanzees, then, maybe there is no moral standard by which we need to live by, and society degrades, and guess what? Then the police come in, and you've now, changed society, and made it into a fascist or a communistic type of society, which we are seeing today.
Slowly devolving into, it's getting that way more all the time. The I keep looking at the people that propose these suggestions, these ideas, and they seem to be thinking, breathing, walking around human beings, some of them even curious, but they're not curious about this. They're not curious about what happens to a society when it throws away principles, when it throws away basic life-affirming positive things that they can live by, and says, well, we're just animals. We're just kind of animals that wear suits and have sunglasses, and they don't question it beyond that. It's the stuff that they've learned and lived with forever, and just kind of parrot the idea. Well, that's the way it always is, and that's not the way it always is. I keep asking why, what is in their benefit? Is it life easier to live that way? Is it more beneficial? Do they make more money? Are they able to progress in their life? I guess I come from the point of view that we all do things for our self-interest, but what is their self-interest in proclaiming and propagating this particular line of information?
It's the desire to do your own thing.
It's humanism. It's a self-affirming, I'm the center of the universe kind of thing. And there, not all of us are happy with that situation or believing that. It's, most of us, I say most, historically, people have enjoyed the notion, the belief, the commitment to a deity. To God, someone who's central and authoritative and sets an absolute standard, and without that, you're a ship without a rudder. But humans, some humans, seem to like that.
I'm wading through the book, The Big Sort, and it talks about the difference in populations and political parties and how we tend to be moving to big cities to where people think like we do and believe like we do and go to church like we do and pursue activities, make money like we do and that sort of thing. And the authors now, and I'm about two-thirds of the way through, have made a connection that many of these changes started in this country in the early and mid-60s, when that particular generation said, we don't want to do it that way anymore. And all kinds of changes began in that particular period of time. I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the book to see if they're able to support this information or this notion with some more basic stuff. But what an interesting idea that that it's not the leftist and rightist newscasters and talk show hosts that are beating us into submission and making us think a particular way, but we've been thinking that way for quite some time.
And I value that opinion from that book, but I'm thinking that was a time where it accelerated. But Don and you and I, David, have talked about this many times, and I thought we had kind of figured it goes back to about the 1890s, 1880s, when it took a nosedive toward humanism. And it had to do with Harvard Medical School, Harvard legal training for lawyers. And it brought about a change, and you can see it even in things like archaeology. When the Germans excavated the Holy Land, and it came up with a whole different, the Deuteronomical approach to the Pentateuch, and thought, and of course, Darwinism, evolution was just coming to a head 30 years after the book was written, the Origin of the Species. But I think maybe the 1960s was a point where another fuse was lit. And finding where that breaking point is, it would be a fascinating study all its own, and probably would take a lot more time than we have this morning.
Yes, I think there are waves, in history, where man is a depraved creature anyway, and unless you have some moral rudder to help guide him, he's going to go off and destroy himself. And I think there are waves or pushes, like you've mentioned, in the 60s and the 70s, that help accelerate the degradation of man's thought, if you will. And I think we're undergoing it even, we're having another wave right now. You know, over the last, five years, it's extreme, you know, the acceleration has been extremely great. Mm-hmm.
Here's a thought, just to place a structure on this, and this goes back to the old Hebrew notion of a 70-year cycle. Now, I'm not into numerology and all those things. I don't know that the number has that much significance, but if you go back to what we might call the first Great Awakening, 1730s, 1740s, 70 years later, there's another wave of spiritual new thought in the Second Great Awakening in the 1820s and 1830s. Then you get up to the 1890s, 70 years later, and there's this change. And what's 70 years after 1890s? 1960s.
1960.
Mm. I mean, there just seems to be a pattern. Maybe it's in my imagination, but that time interval seems to, you know, when Jesus reached adulthood in the Jewish, you know, when he was 12, was found in the temple, that was the end of one of those 70-year periods. And that's when ancient Israel began looking for the Messiah. Their prophets, their philosophy, their cultural sense said some big change is going to happen now. And they were looking for the Messiah. Of course, they were looking for the wrong kind of Messiah. But that 70-year period seems to have application here. And I've never figured it out. And of course, we always get right back to Dr. Don's theory of the devolution of man, that generation by generation, we're just not quite as bright as the ones who came before.
And perhaps the waves are not reaching as far each time.
Yeah.
Or farther, depending on perspective.
Anyway, right. interesting
stuff. Well, going along with that, of course, after something like happened in the 60s, in the 70s, you remember that there was the Jesus movement, and many people came to know the Lord at that particular time. I didn't, but I certainly remember folks who were involved in that that movement. And I think even what we're having today is bringing about a stirring in people to say, you know, there's got to be more to life than this. Mm-hmm. And so I'm encouraged that we're going to see another, another movement of the church, or at least of God, that is going to be revive, if you will, some folks and
another movement,
enhance their
awareness
of Him.
Indeed, Dr. Don, always good to have you, and we'll look forward to next week again. Thank you for the time today. This will be up as a podcast in about midday today, so people can check out the BioLogos link and see what we were talking about today. Don, thanks very much. Be blessed. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Don.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been, as usual, it's been a lot of fun. So
yeah,
we'll
interesting.
See you next week.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Good stuff.
Music from Phil Kagi on a Broken Road Radio Monday morning.
What can wash away my sin?